We're excited to change the world of startups for the better, but trying to make a difference and turning our good intentions into reality has proven to be more complicated than expected. We constantly encounter unexpected second-order effects. When we solve one issue, we end up unintentionally creating another one. It's dawning on you that being a good leader is more complex than simply having that one big idea. True leadership is about the difficult decisions and trade-offs you encounter whilst executing it. On this show, we explore the entrepreneurial zeitgeist with the aim to work and lead differently. Between all of us, we can decode what it will take to be a leader today. In today's episode, we talk about holacracy, asynchronous communication, and remote-first culture. They are three modalities that embrace autonomy and ownership within your team. I love talking with today's guest, Lavinia, because she's so thoughtful. And she also has more than 10 years of unique experience in building remote teams. Lavinia is the managing partner of Livid International, a support system for entrepreneurs and startups who build tech and digital businesses. She's also the founder of the Remote Skills Academy, an education platform for Indonesians who want to learn to work remotely. In this episode, we uncover what it takes to work in a collaborative, remote, and cross-cultural organization. Let's dive in.
Unique is a big word, right? Because I'm very excited to see that more and more companies are transitioning to the new ways of working, right? And for a very long time, I didn't like the fact that we were exceptional because we were doing certain things, because I thought that more companies should do that by default. So I wouldn't call them unique, but a few things that we do that come to mind would be, we use a system called Holacracy that decentralizes authority and basically makes the authority in the organization flatter rather than a hierarchy, like a typical hierarchy. That doesn't mean you don't have leadership and you don't have guidance and you don't have people in charge of things, but it decentralizes authority to a point where things can move faster and people can feel a little bit more empowered that they can remove the blocks that are standing in the way of them doing whatever it is that they're paid to do rather than waiting for approvals and things to happen from somewhere else. So I would say that's one thing. Another thing is that we've been building remote teams for ourselves and for our startups for 10 years now. And back in the day, we were the weird people in the room and everyone was like, why are you doing that? And now in the past 2 years, there's been maybe some of the same people coming back and asking how we're doing that, because obviously over a decade, you learn a lot about how to do things and especially many, many ways in which how not to do things. So yeah, that would be a couple of things that come to mind.
Oh yeah. I definitely want to learn about what not to do as much as I want to learn about what to do. Just on that point of holacracy, I'm curious, what book, mentor, moment in time inspired you to adopt that? And then what did it take to actually set that up properly in terms of like educating the team, educating yourself, starting the processes? How long did all of that take and when did you start?
So we did that in roughly 2016. And it took a while. It took, I think, probably up to 6 months. I don't remember exactly, but I would say until we got, let's say, various teams to the point where, you know, they were running the meetings in a certain way, they were formulating each role, right, and accountabilities and domains in a certain way, so it's clear and transparent for everyone, and, you know, the structure of the organization and so on. I think both my business partner and I have always been interested in new ways of doing things, maybe to a fault, maybe getting shiny object syndrome with tools and implementing way too many tools, right? And then the team is like they're lost and overwhelmed. And then we're like, okay, we love tools, but let's scale back a little bit to a point where it makes sense for people and so on. So Holacracy seemed like an experiment that was very much up our alley, right? And it was an experiment, and that's what I really advise people to do, to treat these things as experiments rather than say, we're now a Holacracy, or we're now a fully remote team, and we're never going back, right? Because you don't know until you try. right? The only way of really knowing is to try, right? So yeah, if you treat those things as experiments, as bets, right? And you look at, you explore, right? And instead of proving yourself right or wrong, you have the mentality of, oh, I wonder what would happen if we explore this or if we tried that, right? And the answer could be that it's a total failure or that it fixes a lot of issues that we had or that it takes us to a place where we didn't even imagine.
What would you say was the biggest challenge in implementing Holacracy?
That's a very good question. I would say making sure that your teams are prepared for full autonomy and that as much as we want to have everyone in a system, certain people or certain teams may need more support than others. It's sort of like democracy, right? You don't just install democracy and then everything works perfectly. No, you nurture a society to be able to make informed choices and to be involved in the process and all of those things, right? So in that way, I would say whatever changes you make to your organization, especially the larger ones, right? Like the entire system of governance or being remote or being async by default, right? Or things like that. You want to nurture your team beforehand and you want to develop those competencies that are needed to thrive in an environment like that before you actually say, okay, now everyone does, you know, you're on your own and you do whatever and there's very little control and whatever. And then you realize that that's an environment where certain people thrive. And that's an environment where certain people will get lost, right?
Do you think it takes any type of like specific personality or background that enjoys working like this? Or you think it's really a matter of nurturing people, educating people, and all kinds of personalities will be able to not only like work in a Holacracy, but also enjoy that type of work?
It's a tough question because I used to think for a long time that you can nurture people, right? Pretty much everyone. And over the last few years, I think that perception of mine or belief of mine is shifting more towards there are certain people that are better suited for an environment of high autonomy. And the same goes for remote asynchronous work, right? It will be the same people that thrive in this kind of environment. Not to say that if someone with a certain personality really wants to get good at it, cannot. Absolutely, they can. But that's almost like the prerequisite to want to get good at it, right? Like to be someone who is self-driven, who wants to derive meaning and purpose from seeing the impact of their work and the results of their work, and is willing to own responsibility. And then also great results, wins, but also failures, right? Because when you have high autonomy and high responsibility, that is inevitably going to happen, right? And obviously, you can make that more attractive in your organization by having a very intentional way of dealing with mistakes and failure when they do happen, right? And that is very important. That is something that we advise the founders and companies that we work with to be very intentional and be outspoken about what happens when we make a mistake in this team, right? Because if you say mistakes that were made not out of negligent and I'm not trying hard enough or whatever are fine and we've experimented with something and it didn't work or we tried something new and it didn't work or we had too much going on and something fell through the cracks and you own up to that and you say, we actually have in our culture deck, we actually have a section about this. And we say, we're actually much more interested in making sure we set ourselves up for success next time the situation comes up rather than dwelling on what happened and who's to blame, right? The idea is like getting an x-ray of what happened so we know what we're dealing with, but projecting into the future and saying, okay, what do we put in place so this is easier or better next time?
Yeah, yeah. I like that because also in many ways between Holacracy, asynchronous and remote, you have 3xing autonomy, right? It's just not one type of work that asks for autonomy, responsibility, being self-driven, but you're basically 3xing that. And so what basically happens if you have a project and something goes wrong, you have more of a, like a retrospective, like how, what can we do better next time? Or how do you deal with that practically, you know, when something has gone wrong?
Yeah, so we look at what happened and what was missing. Perhaps there was a policy around that, or there was someone who could have prevented the situation from happening, or there was a mechanism for that. And maybe the person didn't remember or wasn't properly onboarded, which is also possible, right? Or things like that. And if we rule out that there is already a mechanism to deal with that and it just needs to be reinforced, we then say, what's missing? Right? Is there a tool? Is there an automated task or a reminder? Is there a checklist, a template, a policy that needs to be put in place? Is there a role perhaps that is missing, right? For example, different teams or departments working with a client. Obviously, if you're not going to have an account manager that is on top of everything, there are going to be things falling through the cracks, right? So if you're missing, if everyone's doing their job with the best of their ability, but you're missing that link, right, between all of that, then, you know, those are just some possibilities. And looking at that and saying, okay, how do we do this better next time? And whatever that is, we implement it, right? It's a checklist, it's a template, it's a better onboarding and training experience, it's a refresher training that we need to have with the team, it's a role that needs to sit in the middle of other cross collaborations or things like that.
Nice. Can you explain to me more about your hiring and onboarding? My assumption is that obviously, you know, you have a special culture that you're communicating, I assume, in the interviewing hiring process. And then how do you make sure that people who maybe come from more of a traditional organization have a soft landing and grow into your processes and ways to make decisions?
Yeah, for sure. So I think at Livit, we generally have two ways of hiring. One is a more traditional one where, you know, we come up with a role that is needed and we create a vacancy and then people go through an interview, test, you know, abilities, practical abilities process, interviews with the team and so on, and then they get onboarded. And there's a second way, which is when we work, so we practice a variety of different types of employment, including freelancing, fractional, contractors, full-time employees, part-time employees, and so on. And sometimes someone we collaborated with or we worked with as a freelancer or as a collaborator or partner of some other type looks like they could be great for our team. And then they, it's a little bit of a, I mean, it's not unfiltered, but it's a bit more of a, let's say, backdoor where we say, okay, why don't we explore working part-time with this person that we're already working so well with? And then maybe go to full time or to a different arrangement and so on, right? In which case, we already know what the practical abilities and the culture fit is already. And in many ways, it's a great way of hiring because a lot of people can interview well, right? And they're not always the same people who can perform well. There's an overlap there in the Venn diagram, but it's not always a full overlap. So I'd say, depending on how the person is coming into the organization, if they progressively came closer to us by picking up more freelancing hours or more of a role and whatever, then that's, you know, they've sort of been onboarded in many ways on our culture already. But let's say this is a person who has their first day, never worked at Livit in their lives. One thing that we do is that we have very well meticulously planned onboarding and offboarding actually. And we want to be the opposite of companies where you start on your first day and you don't know what you're doing and you don't know who's supposed to be showing you things and you're just like feeling like you're bothering people who are, you know, have a job and are busy and things like that. I hear that that happens in a lot of organizations, right? When we work with different founders or HR departments and so on. So what we want is we want the person that comes into the organization to feel like they're eagerly expected and welcomed and, you know, everyone's super excited to work with them. So we have the schedule for the first few weeks basically booked in advance, about a month in advance, and it includes a lot of different sessions with the talent department, with the lead of that person, with their team, equally on hard skills or information or things that, you know, where to find work and how to actually start contributing, but also on the culture. on holacracy, on OKRs, on where to find something, you know, when you're wondering about something. Pretty much everything is in our culture deck, where that is, what is it, you know, what to find in there, and going through all our benefits and policies and rights and limitations and everything, right? And I would say the most important thing with that is it being intentional and having documentation. It sounds crazy boring, but that is the key, right? If you don't have these things documented, you're going to, especially as you grow and you onboard more people, there's going to be different levels of the information being given and shared, and you're going to have to say the same thing 1,000 times, you know, with various degrees of understanding and absorption, to say so. So I would say document your culture, right? That can, in the very beginning, can be short Loom videos or a few bullet points or something like that. It doesn't have to be. Sometimes when people hear documentation, they're like thinking like GitLab, thousands of pages, like whatever. It's like, it doesn't have to start like that. It can start very, very lean, right? But the more you go, the more, and have a rule. If you're explaining something 3 times in a row and it, the same thing keeps coming up, document that, right? Shoot a Loom video, create a little policy of 2 phrases, put it there somewhere, and then in time, the body of this documentation will grow and will be sufficient to onboard someone without needing to scale your time or your HR team's time and so on. That being said, don't get the new person to just sit in front of a laptop and look at videos and read policies, because that is not going to work either, right? Like, you want to check in with them, you want to have their lead be involved in this and so on, and be supported by all of that documentation.
That's probably a good example of, like, it's the right thought to document everything, and then you've taken it too far if you hand your new employee basically just a checklist, you know, to read through, and they spend 3 days in PDF files alone, then you're like, we probably took it too far. We got to dial it back, get some human connection back into this.
For sure. That's where you need the hybrid. We keep talking about hybrid. That's where you need the hybrid. You need some async reading that they have to do, some videos to watch, but then you also need to check on them, have a human having a real conversation with them and getting a feel of that, and having various humans, actually, right? It shouldn't be just one person, the lead of the person in the organization, but you want to get various people in the team involved in that. I also really recommend having an onboarding buddy, a person that they will not particularly work with that much, depending on how small or big the team is, but just someone who, you know, is your friend, like doesn't have a formal position in the company that you're reporting to. Perhaps, I don't know, some people may be a little bit worried about asking certain questions to their boss or whatever, depending on the culture of the company and their own national culture, where they come from and so on. So it always helps to give people a friend from their first day and be like, this is a colleague, you know, there's no stupid questions. Whenever you're wondering why people are, I don't know, doing push-ups at lunch in the middle of the cafeteria, go ask this person or something.
You know? Exactly. That's actually a great idea. And the part of the reason why I'm so curious is we're onboarding someone new in January. And obviously, I'm always trying to make that better and smoother and more enjoyable for the new people joining the team. And so it's a good point with the onboarding buddy. I think I'm going to steal that idea straight away. You mentioned before that obviously things get trickier potentially in a remote setting or an asynchronous setting. And I'm kind of like curious also to your point of like things not to do. What are maybe some of the specific challenges or issues around doing all of this remotely? And what are maybe some of the things that you tried that didn't work until you landed at that process that now works for you?
It's interesting because for us, we've been building remote first from the very beginning. So we don't have a before and after to compare. We just have a long series of experiments, right, that we've gone through. There isn't like, oh yeah, when we were in the office, this and this was going on, and now there's all the stuff going on. But yeah, so how to translate things into a remote environment? Like, I this is a really tough question for me because it's literally part of our DNA. I'm like, how else would you do things not remote first? You know, what do you mean? You'd have to go to an office and plug in and use the fax machine or something. I don't know. You know, I would say for onboarding, it's always an interesting one because you, as I was saying, you want people to feel welcome and you want people to feel plugged in right away, and you want them to not be nervous and, you know, ask all their questions and so on. So I would say that some things that work in an office environment work very well in a remote environment, like the onboarding buddy equally works well in an in-person setup and a remote setup. The main difference about building remotely is that you have to be a lot more intentional about it. So in many ways, building remote first is actually building better, because in an in-office environment, you can get away with a lot of things. So what happens is, for example, you don't have a good onboarding process in place and a new hire doesn't know where to find things. In an in-office environment, they can go disturb their senior colleagues whenever they need to, right? Whenever they need to find something, at the expense of your senior team members' productivity, which is not cheap, right? If people need, I don't know, you have a very heavy process where people need 10 approvals to buy a pen or something, that's going to be easier in person because they can just go knock at the door, right, and get their little approval. While if you have 10 different time zones and everybody's, you know, working at their own pace, perhaps synchronously and so on, that might take 2 weeks. So building remote first in many ways points exactly to the inefficiencies and the things that don't work in your organization that in an in-person environment you get away with, right? You actually get away with. And when you move to remote, basically you have to put more thought into designing your processes, whatever those are. You have to put more thought into documentation, into first of all even deciding. You know, I know many companies who don't have not a policy, but a philosophy around things like, how do we deal with mistakes? You know, a unified, you know, like what should be our default mode of dealing when something goes wrong? Or things like compensation philosophy. What do we reward, right? Not only the little scales and grid and, you know, like tables with the actual numbers, but what do we actually reward, right, in this company? Things like, what do our values mean? Most companies have values, but they're just these big words that mean 10 different things to 10 different people. What does integrity mean? Does it mean the same thing for everyone? No, absolutely not. What does excellence mean? You know, what does high performance mean? Literally 10 different things for 10 different people can be, right? So I would say that's the massive difference when you're transitioning into a remote environment or you're building from scratch a remote company. You have to put way more thought into these things. Into what your processes are, what your values are, what they mean, how do you onboard people, what is being rewarded in the company, what rights and benefits people have beyond what's written in their contract, right? Things that sometimes are maybe intangible and so on.
Do you have an example of a livid value and then how that practically plays out? Like what, when you say precise, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we have 6 different values and... So I'm a bit into processes, as you may know. I broke down all of the values into behaviors, into everyday behaviors, right? And those behaviors are, we have a category for basic for any team member, and then we have a category for high performance, right? Like basic things that should be done by each person, you know, to stay in the team, and then what really makes you a top contributor, right? And actually what I can do is go into it right now and look at one of our values and tell you how that is sort of broken down.
I would love that. Yeah. Because I think that's, especially with values, where often the gap is, like you said, they're kind of abstract. And then trying to measure if I'm living by the value or not is kind of abstract too. And I think that idea of like tying into behaviors is very interesting. And also incredibly difficult. So you're basically feeding into my own curiosity by answering this.
Yeah. So for example, high performance teamwork, right? Some behaviors that go under that. Basic ones would be your concise and articulate in speech and writing, right? People don't need to ask 10 times, right? When you're giving them a task or you're asking something and so on, right? or you meet deadlines, communicate in a timely manner, and always deliver great work. Pretty basic, right? And then if we go to high performers, we're looking at things like you maintain a calm poise in stressful situations and you look out for the best interests of the team rather than politics and personal interests, right? So that is like how we make those big words more concrete, right? Or things like if you're a leader, you make decisions based on facts, not based on emotions and favor certain team members, right?
Right.
Things like that.
Right. How do these processes and document come about? Is that something that you're creating? Is there a task force? Is it some of your team leads? How do these documents come to life?
We've had culture decks. It's a document that gets renewed every year in quarter one, and we've had them for about 5 years now. And it's a 20-30 page document, depending on, you know, what's going on and what got eliminated or added or whatever. In the very beginning, and still, I think I'm driving most of it, but the talent department is my partner in that. So basically, what we do is over the year, we have a working document where we keep dropping in all kinds of changes or ideas or things that we want to work on. And then in Q1, we have a quick brainstorm, oftentimes async brainstorm on basically a comment storm where we're like, what do you think about this? What's going on with that? And whatever, whatever. And we usually reach a conclusion. And then every quarter one of the year, we have a culture fest, internal culture fest. Then we kind of launch the new culture deck and company handbook or whatever you want to call it. Different companies have different names for it. And we go through the changes, the new policies. We see if people have questions, concerns of any kind, and so on. So that's how the process goes. And then this gets stored into a PDF, which actually in our case has a beautiful cover with all the little sketches or caricatures of each team member on the cover. And then it's to be consulted anytime you're confused about anything.
So the culture deck is your, we call that like source of truth. You know, if you're completely lost and you only need to find one document to find your way around, this is where you would go to. And everything else will kind of unfold from there.
Exactly. It's like, you know, when you're a team member and you're like, oh, I wonder how much leave can I take to, say, volunteer for something, or where do I need to report that I want to take? I don't know. I have a planned surgery and I want to announce people ahead of time, or I want to, you know, I'm going to have a baby or whatever. Or you're wondering what tools do we use for what? Maybe you're new and you're still confused about these things. You can, of course, ask your lead, but you also have all these things documented in there. If finance is wondering, someone's submitting a claim and finance is wondering, oh, I wonder, you know, what's the allowance or the entitlement for this benefit or whatever, right? Like we have, for example, a well-being budget, right? And a learning and development budget and all kinds of other things, and or a computer like glasses allowance. And, you know, you're like, oh, is this person entitled? Are they not? You know, how much do we owe them for all, everything they spent? Then again, single source of truth, you go and check there and all the answers should be there, ideally. Obviously, not 100% of them are always there, but that's why we have that work in progress document that we drop in things the entire year.
Yeah, you obviously been doing this for 10 years because that's pretty sophisticated and like detailed breakdown of all of the information.
It's actually really streamlined. I think when people think of implementing processes and implementing things like this, it sounds like, oh my God, when am I going to be able to run my business as well, right? Take care of clients and do the day-to-day stuff. And the good news is once you put in place something like this, even in the beginning, as I was saying, you don't have to sit down and write 20 pages of a culture deck. Like you start with 3 pages, you start with a few Loom videos, right? And then that body of knowledge grows, that organizational knowledge, right? And then you have a culture deck, and then it takes you 2 days every year. Not 2 full days of work, but you brainstorm over a couple of days and you update it and you have it there. So it's like minimal effort for something that saves you so much time, right? So I'd like to address that a little bit because we see with a lot of the founders and HR departments we work with, they think it's this crazy, all-encompassing like effort that you have to throw all your energy at, and we're a small company and we can't do that. When are we going to have the time? And I'm like, no, you do it once and then you maintain it, right? It's like when you tidy up your room, hopefully, you know, you clean it up properly and you tidy it up once in a while and then you just maintain things. And the result is that you have a lovely, nice, bright environment to live in, and people are running around like headless chicken trying to look for an answer when everyone else is asleep that could give them the answer.
Yeah, I love that. And this has also inspired me to build out our source of truth document further. Definitely, definitely. And one thing that you just mentioned is like one, the asynchronous brainstorming, and then also everyone else being asleep. You work across many, many countries and time zones and cultures. And maybe you can speak to that a little bit in the sense that maybe what inspired you to work that way? And then also, how does it actually work?
Yeah, so we generally, at any given time, we have team members, collaborators, and clients in anything between, I don't know, 10 and 15 countries. At the moment, I have a very interesting problem. It's not actually a problem, which is that our team members are spread across a number of countries and continents traditionally. And lately, they're all moving to Bali. So I have the opposite problem. Everybody's trying to bring people into the office. I'm like, go, be in the world. And they're all like, no, we want to be in Bali at Livid Hub. So it's interesting. That being said, it's still very much remote first, right? And people roam around. And, you know, I myself am in a number of different countries over a year and so on. As I was saying earlier, I cannot imagine another way than doing things remote first. Like I literally would have a hard time brainstorming how that would look like, you know. And then our clients and partners are obviously, we're a support system for a number of different businesses, partners, collaborators, and so on. And we have partner businesses in Switzerland, in Estonia, in Denmark, in the US, and so on, right? So even if at some point everyone in our team will move to Bali, which seems increasingly possible at the moment, we would still have to optimize for remote first, right? So basically, at the same time, we have a very high variety, diversity of cultures in the team. So we have anything from, for example, Belarusian to Balinese, which are very, very fundamentally different cultures in many ways, in direct and indirect communication, ideas of distance of power, hierarchies, what is suitable to say or do at work, and so on and so forth, right? We were having a culture map workshop. I don't know if you know Culture Map by Aaron Mayer. It's an interesting book that basically talks about cultural dimensions and the 6 to 8, depending on the model, different cultural dimensions that actually define a culture, right? And you can gain more awareness into why you're very different and you're working and communicating and behaving in a very different way from someone from a different culture, right? And we were having a workshop with the team and everyone was like, we were looking into these things and how different those cultures are that we have in the team. And they were like, I don't know how we don't kill each other. Like, this is working really well. This is actually amazing. It's been working really well. And I think a big part of it is awareness, right? Because if, for example, you say, oh, why did that person say they understood and nodded and said yes and smiled, but then they had no idea what I was talking about, and we found out a few days later that they had no clue what we were talking about and what they need to do to follow up on that. If you understand that that's part of the DNA, the cultural DNA that they've been basically nurtured in for a very long time, you have a lot more understanding and awareness of that. And you do things a bit differently next time, right? The way you lead, the way you communicate, and so on, right? If you know that someone else will tell you exactly what they think, even if that might come across as offensive or a bit harsh or whatever, and that is how they were raised, then you're going to be more accepting of that, right? But that doesn't even account for the complexities of all of us spending sometimes significant amounts of time in other countries, immersed in different cultures, and importing some of that into our operating system, right? When things become even more complex. That being said, I think, yeah, the way to do this is to leave time and space for that awareness and for that, the headspace and the both physical and emotional time to process to things like that. And then also very simple principles like always assume good intent, you know, always assume good intent. If something didn't sound right, clarify and tell that person, you know, that sounded a little harsh. Is that what you meant? You know, and they'll be like, oh, no, my kids were about to leave to school and I was in a rush and that's not what I meant. That's what you see oftentimes. So, yeah, cultural dimensions and cultural differences is a big one, but it doesn't have to be so big as to break your team or your collaboration, right? Because we are heading to a world that is even more integrated, more and more integrated, right? Especially in knowledge work, especially in technology-enabled work. There's no other way but to like each other and work well with each other.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think in many ways, it's one of the biggest opportunities we have and breeds a lot of creativity. I wanted to ask you, is there anything that you think is really important for people to know that we didn't have a chance to talk about yet?
In terms of company culture or in terms of reinventing work or things like
that? Yeah, I would say in terms of like reinventing work and the way you've done things and with Holacracy, asynchronous, international, remote, etc.
Maybe something around, I see a lot of teams needing to restructure and lay off these days, right? We're in a tech winter recession, however you want to call it, right? And I see a lot of teams that are or were larger than they needed to be. One of the things that I've been asked about quite a lot is how do you make all these things happen with such a small team, right? Because we're a relatively small team compared to all the projects and types of services and things that we have. Like Livit is a big umbrella that has a number of things going on, right? It has a physical innovation hub in Bali, right? It has a retreat brand, has an academy, right? It has HR business partner services, a recruitment agency. There's tons going on, right? Seven different teams doing lots of different projects and working with clients simultaneously. And I think a few things to keep in mind as we're all heading into a challenging year, right? And we need to look at the big picture and think of how to be smart about the resources we have. There's a couple of things there. I would say optimize for low drama, right? Whenever you have toxic dynamics and someone being consistently involved in drama repeatedly in different situations, don't tolerate that. That creates so much, like takes so much out of a team, productivity, focus, right, energy, and so on and so forth. A second thing I'd say, meetings, right? Show me 10 meetings and I'll show you don't need 9 of them. And I'll show you how to make the 10th of them much better and shorter, right? I actually have a full series of workshops on this because I see so many people spending 8 hours a day on Zoom, right? Working with each other and being in meetings and no time to get actual work done, right? So meetings should be a tool, should not be a way of working, right? And if you cut down on time, you give people more time and more energy to do their actual work. And a third thing I'd say in terms of being smart with resources is build for the long term. I see a lot of teams being built for the fast fashion, you know, H&M collection, the H&M collection teams, you know, that are there for like 3 weeks or something or 3 months at max. If you do that, you're going to need more people. You're going to need more effort. You're going to need more money because you're going to need to rebuild every 3 months. So build for the long game, right? Build to last. It's incredible what a difference can make to know your team, the core of your team, and have worked well with them for 3+ years. Find your people and even take them into different businesses with you. Find your people, the ones you work well with, optimize to keep them with you long term, whatever that means, and just overperform when you do that. When there's very little noise, very little drama, very few meetings, unproductive meetings, it's incredible what you can get done with a team. So I'm speaking to this because I know a lot of teams are like, you know, looking at how to get a lot of things done that we all need to do in the upcoming or current, whatever we want to call it, recession, using very smartly the money, the resources that we have.
I appreciate that. And that's something that resonates with me deeply. I think it's very beautiful when you know your team members, they know you, you kind of know each other's strengths, you know each other's kind of like weaknesses, et cetera. But you know, it's just a thing. You're like, oh yeah, that's what they do. And you just know that you can count on each other and build off each other and feed off each other. It's a very beautiful situation to be in. And so I appreciate that. Where can people, for example, find the series on meetings? And then also tell us quickly about running remote and how people can maybe join you in Lisbon if they're interested.
With regards to the workshops, I do them on demand. I also do them publicly, openly, virtually a couple of times a year. We should probably schedule one, but they can reach out to me and we're happy to make it happen. Both that and other ways of reinventing work and getting rid of all this dead weight that is sometimes, you know, legacies from the past that made sense at some point and now it doesn't. People can connect with me. I think I'm of the socials. I'm the most active on LinkedIn, where I sometimes erratically go in and, you know, put down some things that I'm thinking about that week. And sometimes I don't, depending on what's going on. Our website is liv.it, and we also have socials for Livit, so they can keep in touch with us there. I'm happy to hear from people via email, and I'll leave my email to you for the show notes. With Running Remote and Remote First Institute, so Running Remote is a community that's been running and a conference that's been running for a while. I love going. I love supporting it. The next one is in April in Lisbon. I'll be there, and many of the remote team leaders in various corners of the world will be there as well. Remote First Institute is an initiative I co-founded with some friends and fellow remote enthusiasts, and we are basically getting together a community of people who want to create the global standards and remote, and basically be the go-to when people are wondering, you know, how to do this, what's the research on that, and so on and so forth, and then also be a resource in terms of events and connecting people and so on. So those are two interesting communities for sure for those who are remote enthusiasts or remote interested.
Love it. Thank you so much for taking your time and sharing your wisdom today.
You are absolutely welcome, and it was an absolute pleasure to chat with you, and I look forward to more conversations, public or private, and look forward to hearing from your listeners. I'm always happy to hear from people that have listened to recordings like this, if they agree, if they disagree, if they have other thoughts, if we can help them in any way, and so on. So thanks so much for having me.